The magistrate would physically show up in the forum to conduct business. He would be surrounded by his attendants. He would sit on the podium in his chair. He would carry out certain sacrifices. He would say certain formulae and convene an assembly and then begin business. It was all defined by public appearance and by ritual. And above all, it was face-to-face. The Roman Republic operated on a face-to-face basis. We're not talking about a distant government that treats you through licenses and, you know, submitting your tax refunds via the internet. This is the government that's right there in front of you. This is the government that you can see and watch, and you can heckle and praise as you saw fit. This is a face-to-face system of government. And it's important to emphasize that physical presence of magistrates was required for them to carry out their acts, because we see that in the Roman Revolution, this feature of the magistracy tended to be abused. If you wanted to prevent someone from issuing a veto on your legislation, you could simply prevent them from showing up, prevent them from making it to the podium, and they couldn't issue their veto. So much then for the Roman magistrates. We mentioned earlier that they were elected by popular vote in duly constituted assemblies, and it is to those popular assemblies that we'll turn our attention in the next lecture.
Lecture 18, Governing the Roman Republic, Part 2, Popular Assemblies and Provincial Administration.
Hello and welcome to the History of Ancient Rome. The last time we actually began our examination of the Roman Republican system of government, and what I want to do in this lecture is to complete that process. The last time we examined the Senate and the magistrates. Attached to the Senate, the annually elected magistrates, we examined various aspects of how office holding at Rome was conceived and practiced. And what I want to do today then is look at the popular assemblies, how they were organized and convened, how they voted, and we will also look at the end of the lecture at the system of Roman provincial administration as practiced in the Republic. The popular assemblies played a vital role in the Roman Republic. They were the bodies that elected all the officers of the state, be they the magistrates attached to the Senate, or the tribunes of the plebs and aediles of the plebs attached to one of the popular assemblies themselves, the Concilium Plebis, the Council of the Plebs, also known as the Tribal Assembly of the Plebs, which we'll be looking at in due course. Another essential role of the Populus Romanus, of the Roman people officially convened into an assembly, was the only organ of the state that could pass legislation. In other words, the Roman people officially convened into an assembly for purposes of voting was the sovereign body of the Roman Republic. And in that respect, the Roman Republic was a democracy of sorts, in that the people were the sovereign power. We'll see, however, that in its operation, it wasn't quite as democratic as we might like it to believe it was, but that's a different matter for later in the lecture. Roman popular assemblies shared several characteristics and were restricted by three very important principles. The first of those is that an assembly could only meet upon being summoned by an officer. A Roman assembly did not have an official date every month or twice or three times every month when it would meet regardless of what was happening. It could only come together, it could only be convened upon the summons of a magistrate. If no magistrate or officer convened an assembly, then no assembly took place. So to a certain degree then, the people could only vote and pass legislation and hold elections and so on when they were asked to do so. Secondly, in all assemblies, voting was done in blocks. The individual votes of the individual citizens were pooled into units, voting blocks, that were constituted differently depending on the assembly, and that's one feature of each assembly that we will look at. But the point is that the votes of the citizens were first of all pooled into the blocks. It was the block votes that went forward to determine the decision of that particular assembly. So voting then is always done in blocks. And thirdly, the voting ceased as soon as a majority was reached. All votes were not polled. Once a majority of blocks had voted a certain way, the assembly dispersed and voting stopped. I should also note in passing that within an assembly, all Roman assemblies, it was not possible for anyone and everyone to address the assembled people. Only officers who had convened the assembly or those invited by the officers could address the assembly. So in other words, there wasn't an open right of speech, of free address, where anyone could step forward. Unlike, say, in the Athenian Democratic Assembly, where really anyone could come forward and give their view, in principle, in the Roman Republic, in principle, no one had that right except the officers who had convened the assembly and those that they invited to speak or gave permission to speak. So in other words, although these are democratic in the loose sense, they're nonetheless restricted and hedged about by certain principles and certain practices that are not entirely democratic. There were in the Roman Republic four assemblies of the people, and we've seen three of them already, but it's time to look at them in a bit more detail now. The oldest assembly, as we've already mentioned before, was the Curiate Assembly, the Comitia Curiata, which was an assembly which by all accounts appears to have stretched back into the regal period of Roman history in its original form, and saw the people grouped into voting blocks called curiae. We don't quite know what that word means, just means grouping. We don't know how one was determined to be a member of this or that curia, how they were organized, that's all unclear to us. But we do know that there were 30 such voting units, and that this was the voting block of the Curiate Assembly. The Curiate Assembly is a good illustration of what I said before about the nature of the Roman Republic as being somewhat odd, it's strange, how the Romans were always willing to adapt to new conditions, whilst being very reluctant to dispense with older ways of doing things. By about 100 BC, the Curiate Assembly had ceased to convene as a popular assembly. Instead, public officials representing the curiae met to constitute the Curiate Assembly. In other words, it really had become so redundant and so out of date that the people didn't even show up to the meetings anymore. Only representatives, lictors, showed up to represent the people and vote in the Curiate Assembly. But even though it was sort of out of date and outmoded by 100 BC, it still wasn't abolished. This is the point. There still officially was a Curiate Assembly, even if it now existed only in vestigial form. The main function of the Curiate Assembly, at least two of its chief functions that I'll mention, was that it ratified grants of power of imperium on those magistrates who were entitled to hold that quality, and it also ratified legal adoptions. The second assembly that I want to look at is the one that was supposedly established by the king Servius Tullius, the Centuriate Assembly, the Comitia Centuriata. We have already seen the problems of assigning the appearance of this assembly entirely to Servius Tullius in the mid-6th century BC. It's possible that in its very rudimentary form it did go back into the regal period, but by the developed republic it had become something slightly more complex, was in fact the most complex popular assembly in the Roman Republic. The Comitia Centuriata was the assembly of the people into groups called centuries, and we've already seen the centuries in the Roman army. The centuries were the basic tactical unit of the Roman military, and this is not a coincidence. It appears that originally the Comitia Centuriata was the assembly of the people under arms. It was the military assembly of the people. Those men capable of fighting, those men who were representing the Roman Republic in arms, had the right to assemble under this particular assembly. And for its entire history, it maintained a military flavor. It was summoned, for instance, by trumpet blasts, which were the traditional way that one summoned people for the levy, how the Roman commanders issued orders in the heat of battle were by trumpet blasts. It met outside the city of Rome, because by ancient tradition, no Roman army could enter the city of Rome under arms. So it would meet outside the official boundary of the city of Rome, in the area known as the Field of Mars, outside the official boundary of the city. And so on and so forth. It had this military flavour. But I do want to stress now that the developed Comitia Centuriata had a certain number of centuries in it, but these centuries were not commensurate with the centuries in the army. the centurious assembly, the concept of centuries in the centurious assembly is really a political voting concept. While it might share the terminology of the centuries in the army, they are not the same thing. Citizens in the centurious assembly were ranked into 193 voting blocks called centuries. It's important to examine quite briefly how these centuries were organized. People were assigned to centuries based on their wealth, as declared to the censors at the time of the taking of the census. Every citizen would have to appear before a censor and declare his property value to that censor. At that time, he would be assigned to a specific century for purposes of voting in the Comitia Centuriata. Remember, voting is done by blocks of centuries, not by the individuals. And if we look at how the centuries within this assembly were organized, it's quite clear that the voting was arranged in favor of the wealthy over the poor. There were 18 centuries of men called equites, cavalrymen, who were traditionally the richest members of society. They're the ones who could own horses and enough land, free land, to allow a horse to graze. And so traditionally the cavalry role was the best off in the Roman state, at least in the Roman military, and so within the Roman assembly, the centuriate assembly. 18 centuries then given over to the richest element in society, which would have been, numerically, the fewest. Then there were five classes of what were termed, for the purposes of this assembly, infantry, pedites. Again, this is military terminology, doesn't necessarily reflect military service, but this is the terminology of this particular assembly. Five classes ranked first through fifth in terms of wealth. The first class alone contributed 70 centuries to the voting units of the Comitia Centuriata. Classes 2 through 5 contributed a further 100. So between the cavalry, or the equites, the centuries of equites, and the first class of infantry, 88 voting blocks are already accounted for. So the wealthiest people in the state are able to contribute 88 voting blocks in this particular assembly. As a result, once the voting had reached 97 blocks, remember this, voting stopped when a majority was reached. Once voting had reached 97, voting stopped. And the lower orders, who were arranged together in the less numerical lower centuries, usually never got a chance to vote at all. For instance, the absolute destitute, the poorest people, they were called, rather wonderful name, the capite censi, which means the head count. It means that when they showed up for the censors to assign them to a century and they declared their property, all they could declare were their persons. They had nothing else to offer except their heads. They were counted by the head. The head count were all grouped into one century. And they would have been by far the most numerous. So as long as the upper classes of the Comitia Centuriata, as long as the upper classes hung together and voted together, they could completely control the voting within this assembly. Once 97 centuries had been reached, voting would cease. The main purpose of the Comitia Centuriata was to elect consuls, praetors, and censors, and occasionally, as needed, the interrex. They could also, of course, pass laws, as all of these popular assemblies could do. It served some minor judicial functions, court of appeal in capital cases, for instance, but its chief function, by the time that we're looking at, say, 150 to 100 BC, was the election of the praetors and the consuls, i.e. the very men who would be commanding Roman troops. It's as if the army is electing its own commanders. The third assembly that I want to look at is the Council of the Plebs, the Concilium Plebis, which from here on in I'm going to refer to as the Tribal Assembly of the Plebs. It's often referred to in our Roman sources just as the Tribal Assembly. The Tribal Assembly of the Plebs. And this, as we have already seen, was a bequest of the plebeian state to the main Roman Republic. The Council of the Plebs, or the Tribal Assembly of the Plebs, could be attended only by plebeians. No patricians were allowed to take part. It was organized into voting blocks called tribes. By the developed Roman Republic, there were 35 such voting blocks, 4 urban and 31 rural. The order of voting in these particular meetings was determined by lot. The tribes were not assigned according to wealth, but according to locality, as we've already seen. Tribes were essentially local regions, boroughs perhaps, parishes. It might be a handy way to think of the ancient Roman tribe. Unlike the other assemblies, and because of its particular history, its particular course of evolution, the tribal assembly of the people had officers attached to it called tribunes. Tribunes of the plebs, and they were the ones, 10 of them every year, they were the ones who would convene a meeting of the tribal assembly of the plebs. The tribunes are something of an enigma in the Roman Republic. I don't want to treat them in too much detail. I heard the rather discouraging comment by a leading Roman historian once at a conference who said that as a young man, I really understood the tribunes. When I reached middle age, I began to have my doubts. And now, in his 70s, he hadn't a clue what they were about, which is really quite disturbing. The more he studied them, the less he understood the institution. But they are certainly something of an enigma. They had very important powers, the most important of which was an absolute right of veto, called the intercessio, the right to intercede on any meeting of the people at all and to stop proceedings. They could intervene and prevent an election, or they could prevent a vote on the law in any of the popular assemblies, not just in the tribal assembly of the plebs. This is a powerful, powerful role of the tribunes, and we'll see its potential being abused later. Following the law of 287 BC, as we've seen, the decisions of the tribal assembly of the plebs, plebiscites as they were called, came to be binding on all citizens, and as a result, between that particular circumstance, the fact that the tribal assembly of the plebs' votes were effectively laws binding on all citizens, and because tribunes had the right to veto any assembly, by those two circumstances combined, the tribal assembly of the plebs had emerged, through circumstances, as the chief legislative body of the state by about 150 BC. Since tribunes could veto any vote of any assembly, it really had to get past them and their assembly before it could become law. And so the normal channel was to channel legislation through the tribal assembly of the plebs, just for pragmatic reasons. The fourth assembly of the people is the least important one, really, and was created in response to the incorporation of the tribal assembly of the plebs into the Roman state. This was called the tribal assembly of the people. It was exactly the same as the tribal assembly of the plebs, only now patricians could take part. It was convened by consuls and praetors, and it could legislate like any tribal assembly on any matter that was put to it by the consuls or the praetors. In many ways, the tribal assembly of the people allowed the consuls and praetors to do what they couldn't do in the tribal assembly of the plebs, which was to go and address the people directly. Only tribunes could do that in the tribal assembly of the plebs, but in the tribal assembly of the people, consuls and praetors had that right. So it was a way of balancing the appearance of the conciliam plebis, of the tribal assembly of the plebs in the state. So the whole system then, as we can see, is full of redundancies. I mean, basically what we have are new assemblies being added to old ways of doing things, but the old ways of doing things not being abandoned. They're still there until we end up with overlaps and redundancies. Tradition dictated, practice and tradition dictated that certain assemblies met and convened and voted on certain things. And basically all of the assemblies of the people are made up of the same people, just constituted differently into their different voting blocks. The one exception, the tribal assembly of the plebs, which excludes the patricians. But basically, much the same people are coming together, convened into different voting blocks for the purposes of that particular assembly. The whole system seems almost ludicrous. Repeatedly, when I tell this to my students, they think, how could it ever have worked? It looks so enormously complex. But like I say, if you're the eccentric old man with your cluttered kitchen, you know how it works. Most of us are just seeing this for the first time. It does look dazzlingly complicated, but actually, it worked quite well. The basic formulation, sort of a general run of what would happen, would go something like this. A proposal would be put before the Senate. The Senate would discuss the matter. The Senate would then issue a decree, a piece of advice, a senatus consultum, would be issued out of the Senate. Here's what we think should be done. We recommend that this should be done. It has been decreed by the senators of Rome that the following be done. However, this was not a law, as we've seen. It was merely a piece of advice. For the decree to become law, it had to be put to a popular assembly. And because of the powers of the tribunes, and the fact that plebiscites were binding on all citizens, most of the time the decree would be taken before the tribal assembly of the plebs by a tribune. There may be informal meetings called cantiones, informal meetings before that officially convened assembly for purposes of voting, in which the issue would be discussed, amendments might be proposed and so forth. Once some consensus had been reached, at that point the tribunes would formally summon a tribal assembly of the plebs. They would form into their tribes. They would be asked, do you agree with the following law? Lots would be taken, and the tribes would vote in sequence as determined by lot. There were 35 tribes in total, so once 18 tribes had voted a certain way, the law was passed, and we now have a law. It's important to stress that throughout this process, and this is something that my students always need to be reminded of, the whole system is based not on the potentialities or the strict legalities of this or that office or this or that assembly. It's rather an agreed upon set of practices, the mos maiorum, the way of the ancestors. True, a tribune had the right to veto any and all legislation. My students say sometimes, why didn't they just go out and veto everything? Well, of course, the answer to that is, well, what's the point? You're just going to bring the whole system to a standstill. What's the point of vetoing everything? More importantly, by tradition, the tribunes had been created to protect the interests of the lower orders. The right of veto was, by tradition, restricted to vetoing those proposals or potential pieces of legislation that they felt would impinge on the rights or privileges of the lower orders. And it tended to be that they would only use their veto to veto that sort of legislation. Technically, they could go out and basically bring everything to a standstill, but they didn't. In other words, the Roman Republic is more than anything else a set of accepted traditional practices based upon consensus and definite boundaries, accepted boundaries of behaviour, accepted parameters of behaviour for various officers and assemblies and so forth. We shall see, in fact, that it was precisely when people began to overstep those accepted parameters in the first century BC, during the Roman Revolution, that the whole system began to unravel. It was precisely when people began to look at the potential of their offices rather than at the traditional way that we used to do things, that the whole system began to come apart at the seams. For the last few minutes of this lecture, I'd like to turn our attention to the issue of provincial administration in the Republic as a sort of cap on the issue of governing the Roman Empire. We've looked now at the system of Roman government as it operated in Rome. Several important things that I've stressed that we'll be seeing again and again in the course of the Roman Revolution need to be reiterated. The fact that the Senate had no legal power, the fact that basically the tribunes had a potential right to veto any and all legislation, that only the people convened into a committee could pass a law, and the fact that basically the system worked on a principle of consensus, of agreed upon boundaries and patterns of behaviour. They're all essential concepts to appreciate when we look at the Roman Revolution. But the Roman Revolution also involved the bringing of external affairs into domestic affairs, the use by Roman generals and politicians of developments in external affairs for their betterment in the domestic sphere. So I think it's only appropriate that we look at the system of administration of the provinces as it operated at this time. Despite the enormous power of Rome, the territory annexed by the Romans themselves was rather small. By 140 BC, Rome only had 7 provinces under her control. She had Sicily, created in 241, Sardinia and Corsica in 238, Cisalpine and Gaul in 220 BC, the 2 provinces in Spain, nearer and further Spain, in 196 BC, Africa, created in 146, and Macedonia, also created in 146. Only 7 provinces. Really, between them, comprising not an awful lot of territory, some very significant chunks of territory, but not an awful lot. In no way does this territorial extent reflect the true power of the Roman Republic in the mid-2nd century BC. We looked in a prior lecture at the instances of the ruin of Rhodes by a decree of the Senate, and the incident involving Popilius Linas and Antiochus IV Epiphanes in Alexandria in Egypt, which better reflect the true extent of Roman power. It seems that the Roman principle in the Republic was to exercise the maximum degree of power and control for the minimum degree of direct responsibility of administration. Even within the provinces, the system of administration was incredibly loose. A new province, when it was created, would be assessed by a committee of 10 senators who would be sent out to visit the territory, visit the various communities in the territory, and assess them. In the provinces, the Romans developed a sort of system, not quite the same as their Italian confederation, but a system based upon it, clearly based upon it, whereby there was a hierarchy of statuses for the individual communities. These provincial communities, at least during the Middle and Late Republic, all enjoyed an inferior status to that enjoyed by the communities in Italy. And basically there were three levels of status that one could earn if you were a provincial community at this early stage. Free and federated states enjoyed a treaty with Rome and were invariably tax exempt. The privileges of those individual communities would be determined by the text of their particular treaties, of their bilateral agreements with Rome. Below the free and federated states were free and immune states. They were tax exempt, but they didn't necessarily have a lengthy treaty with Rome. And below the free and immune states was the third and final level, which was tributary states, states that were responsible to pay Rome annual tribute. It must be stressed, of course, that in terms of numbers, the tributary states far outnumbered all the rest. For instance, when Sicily was annexed in 241, the Romans assessed the province. They declared three communities free and federated states. Five others were declared immune, and everyone else was rendered as a tributary state who had to pay essentially an annual tax to Rome. The provincial states were expected to be obedient and orderly and to run their local affairs quietly and efficiently, pay taxes when required, and if asked to do so, supply men for the army. The Romans initially created new magistrates to deal with their new territories, for instance, new praetors for Sicily, Sardinia and Spain, but eventually they gave up doing that, and they preferred instead to extend a sitting magistrate's power for a year or 2 years over a certain area, over a certain province. This extension of power was called prorogation, and it created the terms that we're used to for Roman governors. Proconsul, a man who was there in the place of a consul, or a propraetor, a man in there in the place of a praetor. It was habitual by about 100 BC for a consul to spend a year after his year in office in Rome as a proconsul governing a certain province. It must be stressed that the imperium of pro-magistrates was restricted to the borders of their particular province. One had imperium as a proconsul in nearer Spain, only within the borders of nearer Spain. As soon as you physically crossed the borders, your imperium lapsed. So proconsular power, propraetorian power, was geographically restricted to the province over which you were assigned it. The proconsuls and propraetors and other governors who were sent out were responsible for two things, primarily keeping the peace and order in their provinces. They weren't concerned about local government, that was the business of the individual communities. Keeping the peace, making sure that there were no rebellions, and ensuring that the tribute was always collected every year. Arms and taxes. But they had a minimal staff. They may have brought over a quaestor for financial assistance. Sometimes they had representatives called legates who could be sent out to represent them to this or that community if needed. And they also brought along some friends, friends of theirs who were just called the people who came along, comites, the friends of the proconsul who showed up and assisted as best they could. There was little or no supervision of a proconsul or propraetor in office. They could do pretty much as they wished. So you can imagine that the system of provincial administration of the Republic was open to horrendous abuse, especially if the proconsul or the propraetor had ambitions when he went back after his year or 2 years away, then the potential to squeeze the province that he was in control of for funds and so forth was great. So then that is the system of the government of the Roman Republic, both internal and external. what we'll do in the next lecture is examine something of the political, social, and economic pressures that had built up as a result of Rome acquiring its empire. And then we'll embark on the complex, often harrowing tale of the Roman Revolution and watch this carefully constructed system unravel.
Lecture 19, The Pressures of Empire.
Welcome back to the History of Ancient Rome with the Teaching Company and Lecture 19, in which I wish to look at the pressures that the growth of empire exerted on the Roman state as a precursor to examining the course of the Roman Revolution, which we'll do over the next several lectures. The rapid rise and expansion of Rome within Italy and across the Mediterranean Sea exerted certain pressures and influences on the way Roman politics and Roman society operated that set the stage for the eventual dissolution of the whole system of government that we have examined, the Roman Republic. In this lecture, I'd like, first of all, to look at the Senate a bit more closely, and particularly at senatorial politics and how they operated. Then examine some of the pressures brought to bear on Roman society, the changing face of Roman society that was inculcated by the growth of the Roman Empire, and end the lecture with a rather ominous development in the pattern of agriculture in Italy that was, in fact, to prove the spark for the Roman Revolution. One of the cardinal results of the growth of empire we have already mentioned on one or two occasions, and it's worth reiterating yet again. That is, that by virtue of the expansion of Rome to essentially world dominance in the ancient world, the position of the Senate as the font of authority and political power in the Roman state was greatly enhanced. It's quite possible, some scholars have speculated, that had the Romans not been so imperialistic, if they hadn't spread their empire so far and wide and in so rapid a time, possibly the Senate mightn't have become so powerful, Rome may have become more democratic. These are the ifs of history which we can leave to speculation. The fact was that the Romans did embark on an imperialistic course, and as a result of that, the Senate, as the repository of Rome's chief generals and most influential and leading men, increasingly came to be seen, and I think perhaps more importantly, to see itself as the chief body of the state. It's true that only the assemblies, the popular assemblies, could pass laws, and that the Senate could only issue pieces of advice, the so-called senatorial decrees, senatus consulta in the Latin. But increasingly, the Senate saw its advice more or less automatically enacted into law. And I want to just pause for a moment and just consider some of the physicalities of the situation, because I think they're fully illustrative of the principles that are in action. Technically, tribunes were not members of the Senate. Tribunes technically were not magistrates. They were officers attached to the tribal assembly of the plebs. So officially, they weren't members of the Senate, since they hadn't been elected as magistrates of the Roman people. At the same time, the Romans recognized that tribunes were important officers and were somehow equivalent in many ways to some of the lower magistracies. The quaestor usually was the equivalent of the tribunate, the quaestorship. So there was sort of a nice compromise reached in the way that the tribunes operated. The Senate House was located in one corner of the forum and overlooked the area where the people met to form their assemblies, with the exception of the centuriate assembly, which met outside the walls. But the most important assemblies, including the tribal assembly of the people, met in this area that was shaped rather like a saucer, a teacup saucer, with steps all around the side of it, called the comitium. This is where they formed into their tribal units to vote. This is where the tribunes would have called them to assemble. And when a senatorial meeting was taking place, the habit was to have the doors left open, and the tribunes would sit in benches just outside the doors, of the Senate has. So they weren't actually in the Senate, since they're not members of the Senate. They can't contribute to the discussion, but they can listen to what's going on inside. So you have your tribunes sitting on a bench, or on two benches outside the senatorial meeting house, listening to the proceedings inside, and the people waiting in front. And as soon as a decree had been issued, the tribunes would get up from their bench and go forward and address the people and inform them what the decision of the Senate had been. And then they would normally set a date for a vote to be taken, usually 25 days in the future, for a vote to be taken. In the intervening period, there could be informal meetings, so-called cantiones, to discuss the content of the decree, but then the vote would be taken, officially convened by the tribunes, in that saucer-shaped area, with the Senate, of course, not invited, usually, but standing by and observing, looking down. I think that's rather significant, looking down on the people taking their vote. So in other words, the pressures just by the physical arrangement of the situation in the forum for the people to vote according to the wishes of the august senatorial body standing as a corporate entity looking at them taking the vote was tremendously high. And the role of the tribunes as intermediaries between the decree of the Senate and the passing of a law physically manifested in their sitting in benches outside the Senate House and then taking the decree to the people who were waiting for news of how the debate was going. Anyhow, regardless of that, the Senate then increasingly felt itself to be in control of all affairs of state, but two areas in particular became regarded as the unchallenged preserve of the Senate, and they were the areas of state finances and foreign affairs. In these two spheres of government, especially, the senators, through generations of privilege, expected their opinions to automatically be listened to. In fact, any challenge to their opinions there would be regarded as virtually revolution. Within the Senate itself, however, despite this corporate sense of identity, this corporate sense of responsibility and power that the all senators shared, the Senate was far from a unified body. Inside the Senate, there were strong divisions between various groups. We've already seen the patrician and plebeian division, which seemed to have existed from very early in the Roman Republic. That largely dissipated with the end of the struggle of the orders, but new divisions quickly emerged. The patrician-plebeian division, by the way, I say, largely dissipated as a political force, but it was still socially significant. Patricians were still socially extremely influential, sort of the same way, I suppose, that a person in England who carries an aristocratic name can still get the best seat in a restaurant or get seats to a sold-out concert or whatever by throwing around a name. So it still had some social significance, but as a political distinction, it wasn't terribly important. What emerged instead out of the patrician plebeian nobility was just that, the nobility. The people who called themselves the nobiles, which means literally in Latin, the people who were known, recognized. Of course, is the root for our word noble. This was a small group of particularly powerful families, some patrician, some plebeian, who were at the top of the senatorial pecking order. As a whole, regular or well-established families of senators also had a sense of belonging to this august institution and looked down their noses at new entrants into the Senate, people who for the first time had been elected to a magistracy from their family, and they were called, rather disparagingly, homines novi, new men. Who's the new man? Oh, he's from some family, from some town out in the sticks. Oh, really? Really, a sense of snobbery. These unfortunate newcomers would have a tremendous wall of snobbery to try and overcome to gain full acceptance. We'll see, in fact, that one of our most famous of all Latin writers and orators, Marcus Tullius Cicero, was just such a new man and had to overcome tremendous snobbery at the hands of the established families, and did so in a sycophantic way of adopting wholesale their most conservative opinions. But more of that later. As one looks down the consular lists for the years 200 to 100 BC, just to take a sample, it's worth recalling again that we do have lists of Roman consuls for every year of the Republic. They're called the Fasti. As we look down the lists between the years 200 and 100 BC, it's remarkable how frequently the same names keep cropping up again and again and again. We get Cornelius, we get Quinctius, we get Claudius, we get Aemilius, Caecilius, Licinius, and so on. These names repeatedly cropping up as families who were being elected into the consulship time and time again. They don't monopolize the office. There are certainly new men from time to time, but they definitely do dominate it. In terms of the operation of politics within the Senate, the model that's often used and has been called into question recently, but I think really still is a reasonable presentation of affairs, it's traditionally termed a factional form of politics. Loose organizations of groups of senators coming together over specific issues. We're not talking about party politics. We're not talking about politics arranged along the lines of ideologies, communist versus liberal, or conservative versus liberal, Republican and Democratic or whatever. We're talking instead of very loose alliances of senators who come together for specific issues. They agree on a specific issue, they vote together for that issue, and then often the alliance will dissolve as soon as that issue has been resolved. Some families, especially the noble families, would have gathered around them, especially through the system of clientela, of clientship that we looked at before, fairly consistent groups of support. And that can, I suppose, broadly be described as a faction. The function of the faction, the function of the senatorial, basically the senatorial competition, was to get your people elected into the highest offices of the state. Politics are not about ideologies. Politics are about personal power. Roman politics are highly competitive, personal events. And as a result of this, since the function is to get your people elected into consulships, to get them commands of the armies in foreign wars, for instance, to a degree, the external affairs of Rome become an adjunct to domestic political squabbles and domestic political infighting. This will become patently and painfully clear in the course of the Roman Revolution. But it was always a feature of the Roman Republic. So senatorial politics then, essentially competitive, personal, oligarchic politics. Groups of senators competing with other groups of senators to get the best pickings from the cherry tree. Trying to get themselves elected into the consulships and the praetorships, trying to get themselves appointed to the most prestigious commands against the richest enemies. In addition to the nature of senatorial politics, its factional nature and the divisions within the Senate itself, the growth of empire brought along various social and economic pressures that placed tremendous pressure on Roman society as a whole. As the empire grew, entrepreneurs began to make profits out of exploiting the resources available to them in the new empire. By about the end of the 2nd century BC, a new social class had emerged who were termed Roman knights. I'll call them Roman knights. The Latin is equites, the same name as is used to describe the cavalry, voting centuries in the Comitia Centuriata. It's not coincidental because it's in fact in relation to those centuries that we first identify this new social class. By a law of 129 BC, senators were excluded from those 18 centuries in the Comitia Centuriata, and so this class of equites is first identified to us officially, but it appears to have evolved in the years prior to that. A lot of scholarly inkshed has been spilt on the issue of what the difference between the senators and the equestrians are the Roman knights. Simplistic views have not held any water. Views, for instance, that the senators were wealthy and the knights were slightly less wealthy. That the knights were sort of middle class has not held any water. It seems overly simplistic and the evidence does not support it. Or similarly, the view, for instance, that the knights are a mercantile trading class, sort of like the Venetian merchants or medieval guilds of a later era, whereas the senators are all land-owning aristocrats. That simple division between knights and senators has also failed to pan out when examined against the evidence. It's true that the knights did occupy themselves more openly in commercial enterprises. The outstanding example here are the group of people known as the publicani, publicans, which refers to a very strange, at least by our standards, a very strange practice, which is tax farming. One of the contracts that the censors would let out whenever they were sitting in power would be to farm the taxes of particular provinces. And companies of knights in Rome would basically bid for these contracts. What would happen is the company would bid for the contract to farm the taxes of, say, the province of Macedonia, and then the company would pay up front what they had agreed to pay as the taxes for Macedonia, and then go off to Macedonia and actually collect the taxes, and as much more as they could, for their profit. Another example, by the way, of how loose and potentially rapacious the system of provincial administration was under the Roman Republic. These groups of tax farmers, these publicani, we know were comprised almost wholly of knights. And this is one reason why a view of the knights has emerged as being a mercantile class. But in all fairness, the distinction does not hold up all across the board. Senators technically were indeed supposed to be landowners of the old style, landowning gentry, who derived their profits and money and support from agricultural estates. But we know plenty of senators involved themselves in commercial enterprises. We hear of senators involved in trade, in owning all sorts of property. For instance, Cicero owned a very dilapidated apartment block in Rome from which he derived income from rent. And although the senators might not have trumpeted these commercial enterprises publicly, we know that they did have them. So the idea of the senators has not been involved in commercial or trading enterprises just doesn't seem to work. And similarly, we know of plenty of equestrians, plenty of knights who had large farms and large estates and were therefore members of the landowning gentry. So the best way then to conceive of the senators and the knights is to think of them as broadly the same socio-economic class. They broadly constitute the Roman elite, a new Roman elite. What distinguishes them absolutely and definitely is the issue of participation in politics. The senators were those who stood for election to the magistracies, entered the Senate and took part in politics. The knights preferred to devote their energies to commercial enterprises. As a result, the senators and knights mixed freely. Many senators had plenty of friends who would be knights. Many of those knights would have been richer even than they were. But the interest of the knights lay in a different direction from the senatorial families. These were knights perhaps put off by the idea of politics by its vast expense or the snobbery that they knew they'd face when they entered the Senate. For whatever reason, they chose not to. So broadly then, the knights and senators should be seen as coming from the same socio-economic class. So in sum then, the stratification of Roman society as a result of the growth of empire increased in complexity considerably. We now have a new ruling elite of senatorial equestrian families. Within the senatorial class, there are the ancient divisions between patrician and plebeian. But we now also have a division between the noble senator and the senator who was called the ordinarius, the member of the order. The everyday, normal, unremarkable senator, not a member of the inner clique of the nobility. And as well, we have a broad division between the established senatorial families and the new men. The equestrians and the senators, as we've seen, overlapped, with the big difference being that the equestrians did not take part in politics. As a result, then, the stratification, the changes in Roman society at the upper level are fairly clear to us, even if, of course, the details are always, as always in ancient history, open to debate. But we can also see that there were great changes for the lower orders at this time. These were the men who were the rank and file troops who fought in the Roman legions as Rome extended her hand across the Mediterranean Sea. For these men, the rise of the empire could be a mixed blessing. Naturally, some of them did very well from their soldiering, especially when they were involved in wars against rich, sophisticated, and urbanized cultures like those in Greece and Asia. They could do extremely well out of this and come home rich men from their booty, from their slaves, from the spoils of war that they gathered on campaign. Others, of course, never came home at all. Many were killed or captured, or for whatever reason decided not to come back to Italy. As more and more Roman wars got more distant and more prolonged, soldiers found themselves away in campaign for longer and longer periods. Now, since the backbone of the Roman army was the small holder, the small farmer. This meant that for long periods of time, the farm at home would go unattended. Many soldiers could come back to find their farms in a dreadful state of dilapidation, or even sold altogether. We have a remarkable passage in the historian Livy, which is dated to 171 BC during the levy for the war against Perseus in Macedon, for the Third Macedonian War. The levy is in progress. And Livy is describing the process and showing how certain centurions who had served in a high rank of office in previous wars were finding themselves enrolled at a lower rank under the new consuls. What did they do? Well, they appealed to the officers who represent the plebeians. They appealed to the tribunes sitting on their benches overlooking the levy. The consuls, of course, are doing the levy, but the tribunes are watching affairs. Tribunes intercede, stop the levy, and call a meeting of the people to discuss the issue. The aggrieved centurions make their case, and one man steps forward in whose mouth Livy places a speech. As with all speeches from the ancient world that are written into the ancient historians, there's the big question as to what degree any of these words were actually spoken. But we know that for this period of Livy's history, 171 BC, he would have had sources available to him that were contemporary with these events. There may have been some record in a previous historian which contained the essence of this man's speech. Certainly his name, Spurius Ligostinus, is not an august one. He's not a person who appears in history in any other way except for giving this speech on this occasion. And he's presented to us then, I think we can accept, at least in outline, that perhaps this speech has got, bears some resemblance to what was actually said. This is one of the very few occasions when a rank and filer, a commoner, if you like, gets to have a say in our written sources. And he gives a very moving speech, in fact, a very rousing speech, I suppose, for Livy's readers, which begins as follows. He says, "Citizens of Rome, I am Spurius Ligostinus of the tribe Crustumina." That's his voting tribe. "And I come from Sabine stock. My father left me half an acre of land and a little hut in which I was born and bred. I'm still living there today." So he's exactly the sort of guy that made up the bulk of the Roman legions, the small farmer. And he goes on, "As soon as I came of age, my father gave me his brother's daughter to wife, who brought nothing with her save her free birth and her chastity, together with the fertility, which would be enough even for a wealthy house. For we have 6 sons and 2 daughters, both already married." 6 sons, that's 8, 10 people living in a hut on half an acre of land. This is not a wealthy Roman. He says, "4 of my sons have taken the toga of manhood. 2 still wear the purple stripe." So 4 of them have reached the age of maturity, about 14 or 15 years of age. 2 of them are still minors. So here we have then Spurius Ligostinus, precisely the sort of soldier, rank and file soldier, providing his own equipment. And then he goes on, "I joined the army in the consulship of Publius Sulpicius and Gaius Aurelius, and I served 2 years in the ranks in the army which was taken across to Macedonia in the campaign against King Philip. In the 3rd year, Quinctus Flaminius promoted me for my bravery, centurion of the 10th manable of the spearmen of the Hastati," and so on and so forth. I won't bore you with all the details. But I will summarize for you that Spurius then reveals in the course of the rest of his speech that not only was he a tremendously brave fighting soldier, but that he had spent no less than 22 of the previous 30 years away in campaign. He basically spent his entire adult life under arms fighting for Rome. And he urges the centurions to drop their complaint and to look to their patriotism, because he will do whatever the consuls ask him to do, at which point the aggrieved centurions withdraw their complaint. The fact is, what was the situation back in Spurius's half-acre farm? Well, he was away for 22 years. Where did he find the time to have 8 children is one thing that I want to know. But presumably he was home on furlough from time to time. But here he is. Many, many other men must have experienced similar patterns of military service. Long periods of time away from their farms. And many of them would have come back to less than happy domestic situation. And herein, in this circumstance, lies the root of a growing crisis that was to provide the spark for the Roman Revolution. It seems that as the second century wore on and more small farmers were kept away from their farms through the requirements of military service, and as the senators and the equestrians made more and more money out of the empire, and as more and more slaves became available through the military campaigns, all of this a direct consequence of the rise of the Roman Empire, a crisis was brewing in the agricultural system of Italy that had effects on Roman manpower. It seems that many of the smallholders' families, deprived of their chief adult male, the head of the family, away on campaign, sold out their farms to large landowners who began to create large estates. A later phrase we hear for these estates is latifundia. It means literally the broad farms. It must be said that the evidence does not allow us to say that this was the term applied to these second century estates, but it often is by modern scholars regardless. We know that there was a phenomenon of latifundia, broad farming, at a later age. It's reasonable to apply it to this earlier phase. These senators and equestrians who were forming large estates, instead of using freeborn manpower, would employ gangs of slaves to work the estates. Increasingly, men who came back from campaign or could no longer sustain their farms in competition with these large estates had to sell out and entered Rome as members of the Capitacensi, of the headcount, a landless mob filling the city. Since they no longer qualified for military service, fewer men could enroll in the legions. There seemed to be a crisis brewing. In 137 BC, a young nobleman was making his way as quaestor to Spain to take up his office under the consul in Spain. As he was passing through northern Italy, through the area of Etruria, it struck him how many abandoned farmhouses there were, how many gangs of barbarian foreign slaves he saw working the land in the service of large senatorial landowners. He was greatly disturbed and worried by this development. He determined that he would one day introduce land reform in an attempt to right this wrong and reinvigorate the manpower resources for the Roman legions. He had to wait 4 years before he got a chance, but in 133 BC, this young nobleman became elected to the tribunate of the plebs. He became one of the 10 tribunes of the plebs for that year. His name was Tiberius Sempronius Gracchus, and he introduced in his tribunate a highly contentious land bill aimed at reforming the situation with regard to the large estates and the decline of Roman smallholders. And in doing so, he unwittingly set in motion a chain of events that was eventually to lead to the complete collapse of the Roman Republic and the return of Roman government to monarchy.
Lecture 20, The Gracchi Brothers.
Hello, and welcome back to the History of Ancient Rome. We're going to cover in this and the next several lectures the complicated and often horrendous story of the dissolution of the Roman Republic. It began in 133 BC. With the tribunate of Tiberius Sempronius Gracchus, which we'll be covering in this lecture, and continued down to about 31 BC or so, and the Battle of Actium, which brought one man, as we'll see, to power and initiated a period known as the Imperial Period in Rome, when Rome reverted to a form of monarchic government called the Imperial Period under the emperors. There Therefore, we can see right from the start that the Roman Revolution, unlike many modern concepts of revolutions, was somewhat different. It wasn't a planned event, like, say, the Russian Revolution, enacted for ideological reasons. Nor was it a restricted, fairly catastrophic, short period of activity, as, say, the French Revolution was. But rather, it was a long, drawn-out, protracted spiral